welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and before we get to our first story, just wanted to look at the headline here, Green on Display, and it's got a picture of Leland Bagby, a young boy dressed as a leprechaun who is waiting for the start of the 49th annual Sapa Dapa So Parade on Sunday in Cedar Rapids. There's also a picture of Richard McDonald showing off his Irish flag-themed beard Sunday during the parade. And Kayla Drexler and her daughter, Raylan, bundled up together in the below-freezing weather Sunday during the 49th annual Sapa Dapa So Parade in Cedar Rapids. St. Patrick's waves to attendees during the parade. So it looks like fun was had by all. And now we'll go to our first story. PFAS piling up in trash. Can we keep it contained? Minnesota landfills are experimenting with methods to contain forever chemicals. This is by Chloe Johnson out of Rosemont, Minnesota. The white trailer blends into the winter landscape at SKB Environmental's landfill. But inside, machinery is working to capture one of the most pervasive environmental pollutants of our time. The landfill is the final stop for industrial waste, incinerator ash, and demolition garbage, where all of that material is mixed into massive lined cells. Like in every landfill, moisture in the trash that's trucked in mixes with rainfall and collects into a polluted soup known as leachate. SKB is experimenting with filtering PFAS chemicals out of that liquid. The leachate is pumped inside the trailer, where it travels through several tanks that repeatedly froth it up. These chemicals bubble into a super concentrated foam, much like soap would. Then that foam is siphoned off, and the cleaned water continues on to a sewage plant. PFAS, or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are thousands of chemicals used to make frying pans nonstick, clothes and carpets stain-resistant, and even to snuff out dangerous fires. The chemicals' almost unbreakable carbon-fluorine bonds make them useful, but also ensure they don't break down. They have been found in the environment across the globe, including in the bodies of people and animals. Growing research also shows that these chemicals are toxic, linked to some cancers and reproductive, developmental, and immune system issues. In the past few years, regulation of these chemicals is finally starting to catch up. The EPA set new limits for 6 PFAS in drinking water last year, and private startups are racing to find a way to destroy them. But decades worth of the compounds are sitting in landfills right now, presenting a new contaminant for waste handlers who didn't create the pollution but now find themselves awash in it. Researchers are still trying to understand whether the chemicals are also escaping into the air, whether through gases from landfills, aeration in wastewater treatment, and the emissions from incinerators, said Detlef Knapp, a professor of environmental engineering at North Carolina State University. A few waste companies are trying to get ahead of the curve now. Ryan O'Gara, government affairs manager at SKB, said the company is expecting a future where new regulations would force the waste industry to reckon with the PFAS that are flowing through it. "We might as well be on the leading edge of it, as opposed to trying to catch up later," O'Gara said. And at the company's Rosemount landfill, early tests are showing some promising results. Tests of the filtered leachate show that the process is capturing nearly all of two of the oldest and most toxic forms of these chemicals, said James Licurto, a project manager with the landfill's contractor, Ultra Senexen. Eventually, Licurto's company hopes to treat 72,000 gallons of leachate a day. It's little surprise that PFAS are ending up in our waste. For years, the chemicals have been used in food containers, clothes, carpeting, cookware, cosmetics, and even some medicines, all of which can end up in garbage cans. There's hope now that a wide-ranging PFAS ban that Minnesota passed last year, the strictest so far, will help lessen the burden. By 2032, almost everything sold in the state will have to be free of the chemicals. Some of the most common products that use PFAS must comply as early as 2025, including makeup, clothing, home textiles, and cookware. The federal government is also making slow strides. The Food and Drug Administration announced February 28th that PFAS had been voluntarily phased out of paper and cardboard food packaging in the U.S. In Minnesota, the waste industry has supported these moves, hoping it would reduce their own burden down the line. In historic cases where waste operations haven't been properly managed, the costs have been severe. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, MPCA, has found that 100 closed landfills are leaking some amount of the chemicals, and in the worst case, groundwater contamination was 1,000 times worse than the state's limit. For the most part, drinking water has not been affected, but MPCA does provide bottled water to three families whose well water has been contaminated by PFOA from landfills, an agency spokesman said. In Rosemont, SKB plans to test not only its filtering system, known as foam fractionation, but also several technologies that claim to either lock up or destroy PFAS. In one case, it will try to use concentrated PFAS liquid to cure concrete that would go back into the landfill. The science of PFAS destruction still is developing in a technological race that would spur a lucrative industry. But in another part of the state, waste handlers are relying on older technology. In St. Louis County in northern Minnesota, where Dave Fink manages environmental services for the rural areas outside of Duluth, the options seemed stark. The county landfill serves a large rural section of Minnesota's biggest county. It's one of eight counties across the state that spray their treated landfill leachate directly onto fields. That leachate filters directly down into groundwater and faces some of the strictest state pollution rules, Fink said. But none of them addressed PFAS, and sending the liquid to a sewage plant in nearby Duluth would do little, ultimately, depositing the chemicals into Lake Superior. We wanted to do our part to keep our fraction of the wastewater out of Lake Superior, Fink said, and we knew we could. Knapp said that in many cases, landfill leachate has a higher concentration of PFAS than wastewater, but the higher volume of effluent coming out of a sewage plant usually makes it a more consequential source of the chemicals to the environment. In general, the wastewater industry says it's too expensive and not technologically possible to filter all their material for PFAS. Minnesota estimated last year that it would cost between $14 billion and $28 billion over two decades to filter out all the PFAS that flows to sewage plants. Instead of relying on a sewage plant, St. Louis County is building its own facility on a much smaller scale. It will use two older technologies, granular activated carbon and reverse osmosis, to filter the PFAS out of leachate and then take the concentrated liquid that remains and put it back into the landfill. The hope is to create a closed loop for the chemicals and keep them contained rather than spraying them onto a field or letting them flow into Lake Superior. If new methods to destroy or trap PFAS end up working, there will be room in the new building to install them, Fink said. Knapp said that for the smaller volume of liquids that landfills produce, this loop might work for now. But a few of the new destruction technologies that use high pressure in their process have really strong potential to succeed based on some early published research. The new treatment plant will be built for between $15 million and $17 million, with a combination of state, county, and federal American Rescue Plan funds. That's part of why St. Louis County is using well-worn filtration methods. The federal dollars require the plant to be running by 2026, so the technology needs to be ready. The hope, Fink said, is that the investment will serve the waste system for years to come, even beyond PFAS. We're hoping to capture the next contaminants of concern that come down the pike, he said. Our next article by Jared Strong, DNR finds no living fish in contaminated river in Iowa. State conservation officials found no living fish last week in the East Nishnabotna River south of Red Oak, the result of a massive fertilizer spill at a farmer's cooperative. The only living fish were discovered near Hamburg in far southwest Iowa, downstream of where the river joins with the West Nishnabotna, said John Lorenzen, a fisheries biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. However, the handful of surviving carp he saw appeared to be in the process of dying. "I've never dealt with a situation like this before," Lorenzen said. He evaluated sections of about 50 river miles over the course of 4 days to determine the scope of the fish kill. He had not yet fully tallied the estimated number of dead fish on Friday, but noted that there were also numerous dead frogs, snakes, mussels, and earthworms. The spill is the result of someone at NEW Cooperative leaving open a hose valve that leaked about 265,000 gallons of liquid nitrogen fertilizer, said Wendy Wittrock, a senior environmental specialist for the DNR. The leak is believed to have started March 9th and was discovered and stopped by a co-op employee last Monday morning, she said. The company might be subject to large fines and restitution fees for the dead fish. The effects of the river contamination continued into Missouri, where the Nishnabotna flows about another 10 miles until it reaches the Missouri River. Lorenzen said conservation officials in that state discovered dead fish near the mouth of the river. In smaller concentrations, the fertilizer contamination can result in a lack of oxygen that kills fish, Lorenzen said. However, this was such a large amount of chemical, it more than likely killed the fish from acute toxicity, killing cells at the gills. Lab tests to determine the severity of the contamination were still pending on Friday. The lasting impact on the fish populations is not yet clear. Lorenzen said many of the game fish, such as catfish and walleye, are likely still in the Missouri River, where they stay during colder months until returning to the Nishnabotna rivers in the spring. Large numbers of small fish, which the bigger fish feed upon, have died, but those populations can be restored by fish that survived upstream from the spill or in the numerous tributaries that were not affected by it. It's possible that the fertilizer killed turtles, too, that buried themselves in sediment of the river bottom for winter. Lorenzen plans to return to the area in late spring to see whether turtle carcasses have floated to the river surface. The DNR recommends that residents with water wells near the river have their drinking water tested for nitrate, a service that is free through county environmental health departments. Okay, I'm going to turn to the government notes section. Nonprofit donates funds to Parks Foundation. Also, Cedar Rapids City Council tables final consideration of ban on UTVs. This is by Marissa Payne. Friends of Cedar Lake, the urban lake located in the heart of downtown Cedar Rapids, is disbanding and has donated its remaining $8,858.73 to the Cedar Rapids Parks Foundation as the nonprofit's signature effort to revitalize the lake is underway. Friends of Cedar Lake was formed in 2014 as a 501c3 with a diverse group of citizens who wanted to protect the lake and preserve it for generations. Funds paid for a master plan and events to promote these efforts. That plan is now advancing as part of Connect CR, the largest private-public partnership in Cedar Rapids history. These funds will be earmarked for improvements around the lake that support our vision and the intent of our donors, Felicia Weirich, co-founder of Friends of Cedar Lake, said in a statement. The master plan is being updated on an ongoing basis as flood protection work continues. Through our partnership with the City of Cedar Rapids, the long-term health of the lake will become a reality. New fishing jetties will give anglers additional access points. Wetlands on the lake's north shore will be restored and reforested after flood protection work in the area is complete. Informational signage along the trail will educate visitors about the park's diverse plants and wildlife. Other amenities for Cedar Lake include enhanced park entrances, a challenge course playground, and floating islands. In addition to revitalizing the lake, the Connect CR project will add the Alliant Energy Light Line pedestrian bike bridge spanning the Cedar River, connecting Czech Village and the New Bohemia District. We achieved the things that we set out to do, and we did not want to be a nonprofit that goes on forever and ever, said Council Member Dale Todd, a member of the nonprofit and longtime champion of Cedar Lake's revitalization. As we move into construction phases, it's natural to channel a lot of our work into Connect CR and the City of Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids Council tables final consideration of ban on UTVs. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week tabled final consideration of an ordinance that would ban the operation of utility task vehicles, or UTVs, on City of Cedar Rapids streets. Under the proposed Cedar Rapids ordinance, all-terrain vehicles, off-road utility vehicles, golf carts, and snowmobiles would not be allowed to operate on city streets, right-of-ways, and other public property. Although the 9-member council, with 2 members absent, unanimously advanced the ordinance on first consideration last month, council members advanced it on second consideration last week, but also moved to pause third consideration of the ordinance. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said she was pausing final consideration of the ordinance in light of new information. "There are the people that are going to make mistakes and do dumb things," Metro Can-Am owner Jared Bowman told the council last week. "That's fine, but I think if we take the opportunity to really look at this, give it a chance, other cities like Marion that have permitted the use of UTVs on certain streets are seeing some huge benefits with it." O'Donnell said it's the mayor's call to separate the second and third readings, which the council typically combines when considering most ordinance changes. Todd said, "I believe that there were some reservations earlier that were addressed by the department. If that's not the case, if those reservations are outside of the scope of what was concerning, then I would not support that. A state law enacted in 2022 allowed cities to regulate usage of the vehicles. There would be exceptions allowing use of the vehicles for survey by a licensed engineer or land survey, by emergency personnel, or by a governmental entity or political subdivision in the course of employment duties, such as Park Cedar Rapids work downtown. Allowable uses of a snowmobile under Iowa code also would be permitted. If the council enacts the policy, those who violate the ordinance would be penalized with a traffic citation," Police Sergeant Graham Campshire previously said. Up to $350,000 available for Linn County housing initiatives. The Board of Directors of the Housing Fund for Linn County is making up to $350,000 available in grants to for-profit or nonprofit developers and businesses and to governmental entities for housing initiatives serving households whose income is below 80% of the area median income in Linn County. Priority will be given to projects benefiting those with income below 30% area median income. Eligible activities include development or rehabilitation of rental and owner-occupied housing, home ownership and rental assistance, and financing for the preservation or development of transitional housing or homeless shelters. Applications are available at www.ecicog.org/HFFLC or by request from Executive Director Tracy Achenbach at housingfundlc@ecicog.org or 319-289-0072. Applications are due at the East Central Iowa Council of Governments office no later than 3 p.m. March 27th. Public invited to comment on Johnson County's comprehensive plan. A public hearing will be held today on the next step in the process in updating the Johnson County 2018 Comprehensive Plan, Sustaining Success Through 2028. The hearing will be hosted by the Johnson County Planning and Zoning Commission at 5:30 p.m. County staff will be present. An overview of the updates proposed. County staff will present an overview of the updates proposed. The commission will discuss the proposed update, take public comment, and potentially make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. The public is welcome to attend the meeting in person or virtually. The meeting will be held in the second floor boardroom of the Johnson County Health and Human Services Building, 855 South Dubuque Street, Iowa City. Members of the public who wish to attend virtually can access the link at johnsoncountyiowa.gov 24 hours before the meeting's start time. The proposed new update, as well as the 2-volume current plan, which was amended through May 2022, can be accessed online at johnsoncountyiowa.gov/comp-plan-update-2023. Printed copies of these documents are also available at the Planning, Development, and Sustainability Department at its temporary location on the third floor of the HHS building. The comprehensive plan was adopted in 2018 with the intention that it would be reviewed 5 years later. There will be another opportunity for public input at a future meeting of the Johnson County Board of Supervisors. The meeting time, date, and location will be posted on the county website. Marion Monarch Research opened spring right-of-way tree giveaway. The City of Marion and Monarch Research Project have partnered again to provide residents and landowners with up to 3 free 3- or 5-gallon trees to plant in the right-of-way adjacent to their property. Program registration will remain open through March 27th. Find the link to register and more information at monarchresearch.org/habitat/plantingforward/Marion/. Marion Holding Uptown Parking Study Open House. As Marion's Uptown Parking Study nears completion, the city is holding a public open house from 4 to 5:30 p.m. Thursday in the atrium at Marion City Hall, 1225 6th Avenue. The open house will be in a come-and-go format. All are invited to attend. Over the past 7 months, consultant HKGI has collected and analyzed data and developed modeling projections to guide the city's action on uptown parking needs in the coming years. Projections take into account additional commercial and residential growth in the uptown area over the next 5 years. The city already held a listening session recently with the Uptown Board of Advisors. Knoll Ridge Greenhouse at Easter Showcase taking place March 30th to 31st. The annual Knoll Ridge Greenhouse Easter Showcase will be held this year from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. March 30th and 31st at the Greenhouse at 4900 Council Street Northeast. It is free to the public. The first 500 children, ages 12 and under, will receive a free plant. Visitors will see fairy gardens for sale and display by Friends of Knoll Ridge, a display by Master Gardeners, orchid information and sales by Eastern Iowa Orchid Society, hosta information from the Hashbarger Hosta Society, nature products for sale by Natural Whimsy, and new vendors with products including jewelry and more. House plants, native and perennial plants, birdhouses, and pressed flower greeting cards also may be purchased. Call the Greenhouse at 319-286-5762 for more information. Our next article by Clark Kaufman. No sex offender registry or jail time for Iowa physician convicted of assault. Board of Medicine imposes no sanctions on doctor's license. An Iowa physician accused of sexually exploiting a patient has been granted probation and will not be placed on the state's sex offender registry. In March 2023, the Iowa Capital Dispatch and the Gazette reported that a Linn County woman using the pseudonym Jane Doe was suing Dr. Scott Piper of Cedar Rapids Piper Family Medicine, alleging he initiated a personal sexual relationship that crossed professional boundaries and also involved the regular prescribing of drugs to address mental health issues. Later that month, Linn County prosecutors charged Piper with sexual exploitation by a counselor or therapist. 6 weeks ago, as part of a plea deal with Assistant Linn County Attorney Catherine Shimkat, Piper agreed to plead guilty to the offense of assault causing mental illness. The prosecution agreed that it would not resist Piper's request for a deferred judgment that will wipe the public court docket of any mention of the case once Piper successfully completes 2 years of probation. In addition, prosecutors agreed that while Piper, as a condition of his probation, must enroll in a sex offender treatment program, his name will not be added to the state's registry of sex offenders. According to the Iowa Board of Medicine, it renewed Piper's medical license in October, 7 months after the criminal charges were filed. The board has not publicly charged Piper with violating any of the state's rules or regulations on the practice of medicine, and Piper has no history of any prior disciplinary actions. The civil case that was filed by Doe 1 year ago remains active, with a trial scheduled for November of this year. In that case, Doe alleges Piper served as her primary care provider as far back as 2013. Over the years, Piper treated Doe for anxiety, depression, attention deficit disorder, and polysubstance abuse, according to the lawsuit. In September 2020, Piper allegedly sent Doe a message that said, "It's been a while. Hope you're doing well despite the pandemic and derecho. Been a crazy year, huh? Just wanted to catch up. Scott." The two exchanged messages leading up to an October message from Piper that allegedly stated, "So, after I cut you off, your mom messaged me on Facebook, accusing me of giving you prescriptions, basically, for sex. And she supposedly had messages or texts where I asked you to breakfast. I had no idea what she was talking about. She was going to turn me into the state medical board. It was all weird. I just didn't answer." Later, Piper allegedly wrote again to say, "I certainly don't recall asking you to breakfast, and even if I did, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm friends with a lot of my patients." In April 2021, Piper allegedly messaged Doe and wrote, "I want to make sure that you know my friendship has been one of admiration as you try to overcome your old life. But I want to be clear, in case this is something that you have worried about, that I have no interest romantically whatsoever. I'm trying to figure out how to save my own marriage. That's hard enough, LOL." In May 2021, Piper allegedly sent messages inviting Doe to talk, and after receiving no response, wrote, "Time for a booty call, but no time to get your meds. I see how it is." And later wrote, "You suck." In September 2021, another series of exchanges, Piper allegedly messaged Doe, "Don't you dare get pissy and cut me off like this yet again. I mean, what WTF? I'm trying my blank-ing hardest to help you despite being treated like blank." In October 2021, Doe alleges she and Piper engaged in sex, which reportedly led to messages in which Doe accused Piper of prescribing her drugs to control her behavior, an allegation Piper denied. In December 2021, Piper allegedly sent Doe a message offering to run up and drop off your keys, and then in an apparent reference to her treatment, informed her that from now on, I can't do anything without a legit appointment. Doe allegedly responded, "Right, and what about less 3 a.m. visits for sex with your patient, then stop all meds and contact, and make it then feel like they did something wrong." In January 2022, Piper allegedly messaged Doe about some sort of financial arrangement between the two, stating that he got the line of credit converted to a loan and that he was hoping she could begin making payments. "All I need is the $2,500 and then the $350 that I loaned you from past rent." Piper wrote, according to the lawsuit, "No interest or fees. Pretty sure you can pay me via PayPal. I have my bank account linked to it. My daughter is needing a new used car soon so we can use the money. Thanks." The lawsuit alleges Piper knew or had reason to know that Doe was significantly impaired with regard to her ability to withhold consent to sexual conduct, and also claims Piper inappropriately treated her for mental health and substance abuse issues. In the civil case, Piper has denied any wrongdoing. Okay, I'm going to turn to the insight section, the opinion section, and read the community letters. "If teachers have guns, make others have them too. Iowa's House Republicans' lack of good sense, understanding, and concern for Iowa's children has reached a shameful low. Not only are they willing to require teachers to teach within their selfish, strict limits of conviction, but they also want to train teachers to shoot to kill. Weapons training they would hand over to the corrupt Guns Over All NRA, training that will not prepare public service providers with the will to kill and live with its aftermath. With this logic, the legislators themselves should give up their own million-dollar professional security system and carry their own guns to the Capitol to protect each other from invasion, and doctors should have to carry a gun in their scrubs' pockets to protect staff and patients. Store clerks should have to carry weapons to protect their customers. Bus drivers should have to bring their guns on the road to defend their riders, and so on and so on. Schools deserve the perfection of professionals who are trained and prepared mentally to do the job that unfortunately these times call for. Is this the result of deadly weapons that are more plentiful than regard for human life? When lawmakers make reckless decisions, it is time for a change in how we govern this state. Unfortunately, it might be too late." That was from Janine Redlinger of Lone Tree. Our next letter, Thomas's column on lying ignores a real liar. In Cal Thomas's March 6 article, "Politicians Excel at Lying in Washington," he brought up several allegations about President Joe Biden, but nothing that has been proved, and issues from Bill Clinton's infidelity in the 90s. He also insinuated about the President Biden's cognitive issues. Never once did he mention the president with literally thousands of documented lies and is a candidate who is running again for president. He also didn't mention the former president's rambling, nonsensical speeches at his rallies. I watched the State of the Union and found President Biden to be on point and coherent with a vision for the future. When confronted by Republicans during the speech, he went off script and used facts to answer their interruptions. I'm reasonably sure Trump's response would have to attack without evidence or fact. Please think seriously about your vote in November. And that was from Jay Stolba of Cedar Rapids. Control has corrupted state Republicans. It's remarkable to me how rapidly the near sacrosanct principle of local control has been replaced by state control. Your town wants to try a new economic model? Not in Iowa. Want to keep your gender private? Oh no, that needs to be posted on your driver's license. Your local library wants to support freedom of expression, speech, and the press? I think not. Where there's a whiff of individual liberty, you can be confident there's a state law coming for that. Let's compel all students to sing the national anthem every morning, too. That's what makes kids love this country. Experts can't be trusted, but your state Republican politicians can. Seriously, is there anything they won't regulate? Besides guns and agribusiness, I mean. As clearly as ever, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that was from Michael Kaufman of Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is solely intended for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Evelyn Lipman, 93, of Fairfax, passed away Thursday, March 14th, at Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. A visitation will be held from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, March 23rd, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday at the funeral home with Pastor Randy Kittleson officiating. A reception will follow the memorial service at Concordia Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. Private family burial will be held at Anderson Cemetery in Swisher. Evelyn was born July 15, 1930, in Swisher, the daughter of Fred and Emma Doley Perkle. She graduated from Wilson High School. Evelyn worked for Souvenir Pen and Pencil Company in Cedar Rapids until her retirement. She was a member of Concordia Lutheran Church. Survivors include her two sons, Larry Lipman of Cedar Rapids and Lauren Lipman of Vinton. Three grandchildren, Bess Johnson, John Lipman, and Emma Hayes. Two great-grandsons, Calvin and Baylor Lipman. Siblings, Marianne Dvorak of Fairfax and Hal Perkle of Largo, Florida, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, Fred and Emma Perkle, a sister in infancy, Bernice Perkle, two great-granddaughters, daughter-in-law Jody Lipman, and brother-in-law Ernie Dvorak. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Foundation or the American Cancer Society. Donna Bell Tissinger Wilkerson, 94, of West Branch, entered eternity on Saturday, March 16th, while under the care of the Hiawatha Care Center in Hiawatha. Funeral services will be held on Saturday, March 23rd at 11 a.m., with a visitation with family and friends on Friday, March 22nd, from 5 to 7 p.m., both being held at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Private family burial will take place at a later date in the Petey Cemetery. Online condolences may be shared at www.fryfuneralhome.com. Gerald Jerry Lee, 83, of Manchester, passed away on Saturday, March 16th, at his home in rural Manchester. Survivors include his wife of 46 years, Susan Lee, of Manchester, their son, Kelly McDowell, of Manchester, three grandchildren, Alec McDowell, Emma McDowell, and Elizabeth McDowell, three step-grandchildren, Kayla, Kylie, and Lucas Chestnut, two brothers, James Lee of Oklahoma and Robert Lee of Colorado, two brothers-in-law, Steve Billhorn of Manchester and Alan Billhorn of Des Moines. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmullerfh.com. Private family graveside services will be held. Jeanette Ruth Wilson, 87, of Walker, passed away unexpectedly on Friday, March 15th, at her home. The family will greet friends from 12:30 to 2 p.m. on Thursday, March 21st, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will follow at 2 p.m. at the funeral home, with Mike Schultz officiating. Burial will take place at Lafayette Cemetery in Albernett. Jeanette was born on July 23, 1936, in Avoca, the daughter of Harry William and Evelyn Usel Bauer Fennern. She graduated from high school in Garrison. On June 29, 1956, Jeanette was united in marriage to William Bill James Wilson in Marion. Jeanette was easygoing, optimistic, and the nicest person you'll ever meet. She loved the outdoors, including camping, fishing, daily walks with her dog, and tending to and keeping a meticulous yard full of flowers. Jeanette loved the Iowa Hawkeyes, but most of all, she loved spending time with her family. She will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Jeanette is survived and lovingly remembered by her children, Bill Wilson of Lisbon, Cindy Carson of Marion, and Rick Wilson of Toddville. Grandchildren Holly Carson, Matt Wilson, Greg Carson, Deborah Wilson, Emily Beck, Kaylee Anderson, Mike Novak, and Hunter Novak. 20 great-grandchildren. Siblings Donald Fennern of Cedar Rapids, Joan Abernathy of Vinton, Mary Schottmer of Atkins, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband Bill Wilson, her parents Harry and Evelyn Fennern, siblings Robert, Lila, Jack, Marvin, Richard, and John Fennern. Memorials in Jeanette's memory may be directed to the Especially for You race by mail at Mercy Medical Center. Renee Ray Marconi, 73, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, March 14th. A funeral service will take place at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, March 20th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. The family encourages guests to wear Hawkeye colors. Burial will be at the Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Renee was born August 4, 1950, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Claire, Connie, Hardin, and William Hap Wims. She graduated from Prairie High School and went on to attend the University of Iowa. Rena was united in marriage to Roger Marconi. The couple later divorced. She worked for Hy-Vee until her retirement in 2023. Rena was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan. She was deeply engaged in the arts, participating as both an actress and stagehand with Kirkwood Performing Arts. Rena's commitment extended to serving on the board of directors for the Amana Performing Arts Center. Survivors include her sons, Chris Marconi of Norway, Iowa, and Brian Marconi of Cedar Rapids, siblings Luann Callison of Des Moines, Vicki Slager of Marion, William H. Wims, Jr. of Anamosa, and lifelong friend Vicki Walsher of Rowley. She was preceded in death by her parents, Connie and Hap Wims, and former husband Roger Marconi. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Critter Crusaders of Cedar Rapids or the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. There's a picture in the way of my words here. Well, I'm going to try reading this. See if I can get it read. Joanne Quint Jerosik, 93, of Marion, passed away with her family by her side on March 14th at Northbrook Care Center in Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends from 4 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, March 19th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, March 20th, at the funeral home, with an additional visitation 1 hour prior to the service. And I am very sorry. There is something in front of this. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to be able to read the rest of that. But down here at the bottom, it does say you could go to www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. That was Joanne Quint. So sorry. Rosemary Ruzicka Gibbon, 82 of Cedar Rapids, entered into eternal life on Wednesday, December 20th. The Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd at St. Wenceslas Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids, celebrated by Father Dennis Conway. Burial will follow at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Papich Kuba Funeral Service is serving the family. William Bill P. Conway, 67, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully with the family by his side on Friday, March 8th at Heritage Specialty Care. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Entombment at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Papich Kuba Funeral Service is serving the family. Bill is the son of Jack and Connie Kregel Conway, was born in Cedar Rapids on April 14, 1956. He graduated from Kennedy High School. As a lifelong member of St. Matthew's Church, Bill enjoyed helping clean the church after Masses and performing other chores that needed to be done. He loved his dogs, Frenchie and Max, going to ball games, bowling with his friends, hanging out with family, and Coca-Cola. His courage was an inspiration to everyone who knew him. He will always be in our hearts. Bill is survived by siblings John Conway of Grimes, Mary Victor of Omaha, Nebraska, Jim Conway of Cedar Rapids, Anse Corrine Pavich of Phoenix, Arizona, and Katie Kregel of Fort Dodge, and many beloved nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents. Special thanks to the staff at Heritage Specialty Care for their many years of care, support, and friendship, and Mercy Hospice for their support and comfort in Bill's final weeks. A very, very special thanks to Mom for the selfless love and devotion she gave Bill throughout his life. In lieu of flowers, please consider making a memorial contribution in Bill's honor to the Ark of East Central Iowa, or Hospice of Mercy, through the Mercy Foundation. Sue Hathaway, 76, of Keystone, passed away peacefully on Friday, March 15th, with family by her side. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 20th, at Blairstown Presbyterian Church. The Reverend Diane S. Voorhees will officiate. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Sue was born on October 2nd, 1947, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Alvin and Lucille Dietrich Erger. She married Robert C. Hathaway on October 20th, 1979, in Nashua. She was known in the community for her delicious cakes. She spent many years baking cakes for everyone's special occasions and was the former owner of Sue's Bake Shop in Belle Plaine. She was a woman of faith and an active member of the Blairstown Presbyterian Church. She is survived by her children, Rob Hathaway of Belle Plaine, David Hathaway of New York, and Chris Vest of Belle Plaine. Her grandchildren, Blake Youngman of Belle Plaine, Chelsea Steckley of Williamsburg, Samantha Brecht of Amana, and Ariel Knapp of Marengo, and seven great-grandchildren whom she cherished very much. She was preceded in death by her husband, Robert C. Hathaway, her parents, and a brother. Sue will be greatly missed by her family and friends. Please, you can please leave a message on our webpage, www.cedarmemorial.com, under obituaries. And one more. Norman Glenn Fitzgerald, 90, of Marion, passed away on Friday, March 15th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha, surrounded by his family. The family will greet friends from 9 to 11 a.m. on Tuesday, March 19th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, preceding the 11 a.m. funeral service. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Norman was born on March 8, 1934, in Cedar Rapids, the son of James and Bernice Hempy Fitzgerald. He was a 1952 graduate of Marion High School and went on to attend Iowa State. On February 14, 1992, Norman was united in marriage to Janice Bailey at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. He was a farmer and worked for Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids for 30 years until his retirement. Norman continued to farm long after retirement. He enjoyed golfing, fishing, playing games, working puzzles, bowling, traveling, and being outdoors. He also enjoyed collecting Alice Chalmers tractors, running his train set, watching NASCAR, and the Iowa Hawkeyes. Norman will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. Norman is survived and lovingly remembered by his wife of 32 years, Janice Fitzgerald, five children, Steve Fitzgerald of Monticello, David Fitzgerald of Springville, Ann Knupp of Springville, Matt Fitzgerald of Olin, and Mary Nelson of Cedar Rapids. Three stepchildren, Janlyn Slack of West Branch, Deborah Shoot of and Jay Bailey, both of Wichita, Kansas. 13 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents and one great-granddaughter. Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section. You can catch on in the NBA the Heat at the 76ers at 6:30 p.m. tonight on ESPN, and the Trailblazers at the Bulls at 7 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. The Knicks at the Warriors at 9 p.m. on ESPN. Okay, our story from the cover page. NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament, Iowa State. ISU gets 2 seed headed to Omaha. Otzelberger will face familiar team in South Dakota State. By Rob Gray. The NCAA Tournament Selection Committee insists that it never looks at potential storylines when it's determining first-round matchups. But shortly after Iowa State head coach T.J. Otzelberger saw his team had been nabbed as a number 2 seed, a plot twist popped up. The Cyclones, whose record is 27-7, will face the program that gave Otzelberger his first college head coaching job, South Dakota State, in Thursday's first-round tournament game in Omaha. The winner faces number 10 seed Drake, whose record is 28-6, or number 7 seed Washington State, whose record is 22-12. Iowa State head coach T.J. Otzelberger hoists the trophy. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a picture they've shown of T.J. Otzelberger hoisting the trophy after winning the Big 12 men's tournament championship game against Houston on Saturday in Kansas City. I'm sorry, that kind of jumped in between my sentence here. I apologize. So the winner of that matchup with the Cyclones and South Dakota State will face number 10 seed Drake or number 7 seed Washington State in the second round on Saturday. Suffice it to say, Otzelberger's ties to the 15th seeded Jackrabbits, whose record is 22-12, and head coach Eric Henderson still run deep. They won the Summit League outright. They won the tournament, said Otzelberger, who served as South Dakota State's head coach from 2017 to 2019. To do that, you've got to have a really good group, and I've watched them a fair amount this season just because of, obviously, my relationship with Coach Henderson and their coaching staff in my time there. Henderson served as Otzelberger's associate head coach in the 2018-19 season and was elevated to the top spot when Otzelberger left to coach at UNLV the following season. Several members of his staff previously coached under Otzelberger there as well, so there are myriad connections linking the two programs together. Those relationships and things, those matter a lot, but at the same time, we know when you get to this point of the year, there are only so many options where things are going to go a certain way, so you just take it as it comes like we do everything, Otzelberger said. Just get ready for what's next and prepare to be at our best to go win the game. ISU showed throughout the season it can narrow its focus onto itself and not allow any added intrigue to seep into its habit-based approach to achieving success. The Cyclones have also been extremely balanced offensively, which helped them record 3 straight double-digit wins at the Big 12 tournament to win the crown for the first time since 2019. ISU has won 6 of its last 7 games, and each of those games featured a different leading scorer. This is a whole new ball game for everybody, said ISU senior forward Trey King, who was one of those 7 players to lead the team in scoring in the past 7 games. There's different ways you've got to prepare for scouting, and I think the one advantage that we have with different leading scorers every night is teams don't know who to really key in on because it really could be anybody on any given night. I think that's just a credit to how much we share the ball and care for each other and really just make the simple plays and stuff like that. That's what the 7th-ranked Cyclones did in Saturday's 69-41 rout of top-ranked Houston in the Big 12 tournament title game, and that's what prevents early exits from happening. King played in last year's first-round tournament loss to 11th-seeded Pitt, a deflating upset based on storyline he's convinced won't receive a sequel. In all of these big moments, we've all showed up and shown out and done what we needed to do, King said. So I have no doubt that we're going to do that again. And under that story, we've got the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. Hawks the top dogs. But Iowa draws the number one seed on Murderer's Row. For the first time in 31 years, the Iowa Hawkeyes are an NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament one seed, the top team in the Albany 2 region. The Hawkeyes, whose record is 29-4, learned their postseason fate Sunday at Carver Hawkeye Arena. Now it's up to them to do something significant with it. Iowa was a one seed in 1988 and 1992, and neither translated to a Final Four berth. Both of the Hawkeyes' Final Four runs in 1993 and 2003 came as two seeds. Iowa will face either Holy Cross, whose record is 20-12, or Tennessee Martin, whose record is 16-16, in the first round Friday or Saturday at Carver. Times and dates are to be determined. Hey, in NCAA Wrestling Championships, plenty of intrigue awaits state's programs. Five biggest questions for the NCAA tournament. The field and the brackets have been set for the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships, March 21st through 23rd at T-Mobile Center in Kansas City, Missouri. Plenty of intriguing storylines for all three state schools and former Iowa preps in the field. Here are five things to watch. Iowa's rebound. The Hawkeyes enter the national tournament after a fourth-place team finish without an individual champion at the Big Ten tournament. They have the potential place higher at the NCAA tournament than in the qualifier. Finalist streak at risk. Iowa doesn't have a wrestler seated in the top two of their weight class. FlowWrestling.com's Andy Hamilton reported this is just the third time since 1975 that had happened. Iowa has nine wrestlers in the field. NCAA finalist Riel Woods at 141 pounds, Drake Ayala at 125, lead the way as number three seeds. Michael Caliendo, who was an All-American last season at North Dakota State, provides another medalist candidate at the number six seed at 165. Zach Glazier has produced one of the top seasons with a 24-2 mark, with his lone losses coming to Penn State's top-ranked three-time NCAA champion Aaron Brooks, including one in the Big Ten Championship Finals. Corey Clark made the 133-pound finals in 2015 as the number three seed. Mark Perry was the number four seed at 165 in 2005. The Hawkeyes are in jeopardy of not having a finalist for the first time since 1989. The freshman seasons of Tom and Terry Brands, the only time since 1974 that has happened. Iowa has a few wrestlers with the potential to take the Saturday night stage. Ayala is one of the leaders in what can be called as the most unpredictable weight class of the entire season. Upsets galore. Even Stanford's number 14 seed, Nico Provo, who could be Ayala's second-round foe, was ranked number one nationally at one point. And the Cyclones. Iowa State has impressed in tournament competition. Remember when the Cyclones captured the Cliff Clean Las Vegas Invitational in December? It was just a precursor to winning its first Big 12 Championships team title since 2009. Iowa State also has nine qualifiers looking to improve last year's 11th-place finish, which was the best under seven-year head coach Kevin Dresser. The Cyclones are poised for their first top 10 finish since getting third in 2010, which was Kevin Jackson's first year as head coach. Younger Batista leads the way as the number two seed at heavyweight. He is 24-0 and has displayed power and athleticism, moving up from 197. He beat Air Force's Wyatt Hendrickson in the conference finals, handing him his lone loss. The pair could meet again in the semifinal. Iowa State also has fourth-seeded and former NCAA champion David Carr at 165. Cyclones have much more balance than previous season. Anthony Ekamendia is the number five seed at 141. Evan Frost at 133 has had a breakout season and is the number eight seed, as is 149-pounder Casey Swiderski. Cody Chittum at 157 and 184-pound All-American Will Feldkamp, a transfer from Clarion, can reach the podium. Iowa State could produce its best finish under Dresser. Kekkonen's dominance. Few wrestlers have been dominant like Northern Iowa's top-seeded 184-pounder Parker Kekkonen. He was an NCAA runner-up last season, placing third his first two seasons. Kekkonen owns a 26-0 record and has posted his wins and has posted his wins. That doesn't make any sense. Apparently, his wins were impressive. He has an 88.5 bonus victory rate, tallying 11 major decisions, 10 technical falls, and 2 pins. Kekesson has pulled away from the field, beating Oklahoma State's second-ranked and third-seeded Dustin Plott 14-5 for his third straight Big 12 title. And South Dakota State's Tanner Sloan is 23-1 this season, and coming off a Big 12 title at 197, he is the number 3 seed for the Jackrabbits. Alburnett's 2-time state champion and world silver medalist is looking for his second straight All-American performance. Sloan was the 197 runner-up last season. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.